Part 3. Dorothy. Breakdown. Earlier. You're scalding yourself under the hotel shower, trying to wash the feel of his fingers off you, when you hear the telltale chirp of an incoming text from your phone. The finger feel is everything. You tense as you massage your abrasions, trying to brush off your own awareness of how little you meant to him. Not even the joyful sharing of sex with a near stranger. But the real world is outside the curtain, buzzing on the sink side like a lonely vibrator. It's someone on your priority list. It won't shut up. So after another minute or so, you turn off the shower and clamber out of the tub. You towel off briefly, then when your hands are dry, you carry the phone through into the bedroom, caressing it until it calms down. Bored? It's from Liz. Your throat swells. You sit down on the end of the bed and give in to the sniffles for a couple of minutes. My life is shit. That's a given. For a well-adjusted bi-poly femme, you're having remarkably bad luck. Stranded up here in Edinburgh, dumped by Julian, your primary, you let Liz's insecurity drive you into nothing good. But being a victim is a state of mind, isn't it? Isn't it? You shiver and glance at the door, dead-bolted, and with the additional security of a barbed carpet wedge you bought on eBay. He's out there, in room 502, two floors up and one corridor over. You can feel him, or maybe it's just the weight of your own queasy awareness pressing down on you. Pull yourself together. It's not like he's going to break in and rape you, is it? He's just a nasty wee shite, as they say hereabouts. A misogynistic pick-up artist who's too cheap to use a tissue. Keep telling yourself that, Dorothy. There's another muted buzz from your phone in a cadence that tells you it's a work message. But you really aren't in the mood for the office on-call tap dance. You're disturbed, lonely, and very pissed off. Partly at yourself for not spotting the sleazebag in advance, but mostly at him for being... what? You don't blame a scorpion for stinging. It's in his nature. Instead, you deal with bug spray and boot heel and extreme prejudice. You feel like an idiot because, admit it, you wanted a bit of excitement rather than a nice hot cup of cocoa and Liz. Liz isn't exciting. She's a bit clingy, and what's left over from her compartmentalized cop life is boringly normal. Civil partnership, not swingers club. So you went looking for excitement, nearly overran your safe word, and now you're projecting all over the other. Way to behave like a grown-up. The phone buzzes again. Work is calling. It's the backside of 10 o'clock, according to the hotel clock radio. Responsible grown-ups who get work calls at that time of night check to see if it's important. The hotel comps guests a yukata, so you drop the towel and wrap the robe around yourself, then wipe your eyes and grab a hairband before you answer. With customers all the way out to the Pacific Northwest, there's always the risk of an incoming teleconference. But when you put your specs on and glance at the log, it's just a priority-tagged wave. Urgent case review requested. Oh, for fuck's sake! You follow the link, which leads into the agency's human resources back-office cloud. There's an employee profile. They're asking you to fill out an anonymized interpersonal ethics evaluation. Snitcherific, you think, and open it, expecting to be asked to crit one of the Eager Beaver banking IT managers you were meeting with this afternoon. Instead, it opens on a mugshot of John Christie and a quiz that, after a second of dumbstruck confusion, you recognize as the PCLR psychopathy checklist. Hot and cold chills mesh with nauseated recognition. You cancel out of the form frantically, racking your brain for a connection. Head office booked you into this hotel, didn't they? What did Christie say? Here on business? Did someone put him here? But how would they know? The front desk? Your luggage problem? His luggage problem? They put the frighteners on you to drive you out of your comfort zone, then banged you together with him. Emphasis on bang. They. Who? It stinks. You worked for McCluskey Williams for 3 years before they were taken over by Accenture, and 3 years since, as an independent division, and there's no way anyone at head office would pull a stunt like that. It'd be a Section 4 fail for starters, with 5 or 6 other ethical violations on top, and the consequences for an ethics compliance group of failing a moral standards audit start with drastic and go rapidly downhill. Reluctantly, you open up the wave and follow the link back to the snitch wizard. Yes, it's him all right. You try to cross-reference to find his employer, but there's nothing in the system. Digging diligently, you get nowhere except that bloody Wikipedia true crime article about his long-since-hanged namesake. There's no job number or contract associated with this job. It just came up in the system. Your skin crawls as you think about what it means. You prod your way through the snitch wizard, following the script. Glibness, superficial charm, check. Cunning, manipulative, check. Promiscuous sexual behaviour. Now, hang on a minute. The psych text betrays an implicit polyphobic bias. Reluctantly, check. Your stomach clenches as you work down the list. You should have seen this coming for yourself. It was all there in front of you, wasn't it? Christie is a poster child for narcissistic personality disorder, and you walked straight into it. The quiz vanishes, to be replaced by another inventory questionnaire, this one more mundane. It's an appraisal that evaluates key personality traits in an executive founder. Private equity outfits and VCs use it to filter their trained startup monkeys. The target is, your heart sinks, John Christie. "What the fuck?" you mumble to yourself, just as your phone vibrates again. It's your private personality module. You glance at the touchscreen, leaving the quiz floating open in your specs. It's Liz again. "Are we still on for Saturday?" You flip the phone out of work personality. "You home?" you text. "Yes." "Can I come round?" After a moment, you reluctantly add, "Need company." There's nothing for a minute. Then a tag pops up, showing an address book entry and a handy route map. Your heart flip-flops. All of a sudden, a cup of emotional cocoa with Miss Klingy is looking... well, you'll get restless eventually, but right now you're halfway to totally creeped out and in need of hugs and reassurance. "Be right round. Need to talk." Then you go hunting for clean underwear. Embarrassingly, excruciatingly, the panic attack you've been bottling up washes over you like a drenching cold ocean breaker just as you reach the end of Liz's leafy alleyway. You catch yourself and lean against a mossy stone wall, shuddering with fear, eyes clenched shut, twitching at the sound of every passing vehicle. It's dusk, and there are no other pedestrians around, which is a small mercy. The lane's cobblestoned, with century-old trees lining the pavements and lending the air of a damp, greenish odour. There's a faint sound of running water from the stream beyond the dead end of the alley. It's mortifying. What if... your subconscious nudges you. What if Liz can see through you? What if she doesn't take you seriously? You force yourself to stand up, afraid of smearing lichen on your jacket. Something flitterbuzzes overhead. A bat, perhaps, or a council drone checking for broken paving stones. What if she thinks you fucked Christie to get at her? Everything's bubbling up from the depths of your subconscious, like methane clathrates bursting from an overheated ocean floor. You freeze, unable to make your traitor feet move towards her door. But then you remember what lies behind you in the dusk-haunted corridors of the hotel. Can't go forward, can't go back. It's the existential dilemma in a nutshell, isn't it? You're scared of what Liz will think of you, that's a given. But the flip side of the coin is that you're scared of what Christie could do to you. That makes things a lot clearer, for which you are duly grateful. Hi, dear. Do you mind if I borrow your futon for the night? I just fucked a psychopath, and I'm afraid he's stalking me via my employers. It's not much of a script, but at least it's there. Your left foot slides forward, almost against your will, then your right. It's going to be all right, you think. Until you climb the 6 stone steps to the wee front door of the colony flat and ring the doorbell, at which point you lose it again. Liz. It's complicated. Later. It's morning, and you're on the beat. High pay grade, brightly polished boots, but boots nonetheless. That's what it always comes back down to. Boots directed by Boots, the Bayesian Objective Officer Tracking System, an expert system by any other name to tell you which street to walk down. You can't do policing without boots, whether physical lumps of leather or virtual chunks of software. It takes Boots to track down and interview the witnesses, Boots to comb the incident scene for debris and clues, Boots to define a territory and remind the trolls who the streets belong to, Boots to do the necessary social work clean-up duty after hours on a Saturday night, Boots to do the personnel task assignments and match capabilities to needs, Boots to take a series of jobs and parcel them out as efficiently as possible. Boots are an integral part of the process. It's not like the brass don't know this, even though they're always looking for an alternative. Surveillance drones in the sky, peepers on segways rolling alongside the gutters, social networking crime stoppers and anti-alcoholism initiatives. Boots are labour-intensive. They take training and command and control resources, and they can't give you scalable efficiency improvements. So they're unpopular with the buzzword-wielding consultants who keep coming back to shape your political master's outlook an election or two after they got booted the last time for costing too much. This morning, you started by going straight to the shift change Babylon briefing, your head still a-churn from the late-night encounter with Dorothy. And lo, Dickie's got a job for you. Liz, we've got one that's right up your street. The moustache twitches in something between a smile and a snarl. A possible expert witness for you to interview here, a Dr. Adam MacDonald of the University Informatics Department. He flicks a tightly knotted bundle of mind map notes at you. He's an expert on the emergent behaviour of distributed oracular systems, whatever they are, and I want you to go pick his brains. A sniff. One of your Europol contacts raised it this morning, and Boots fingered you to talk to him. Some pish about research into using social networks to distribute subtasks contributing to a fatal outcome. You ken it bears on that line about sabotage dishwashers and backstreet fabs you've been pushing. You're too tired to raise an eyebrow at the fact that Dickie's actually been paying attention to anything you minuted. Wouldn't that be a common cause charge if we find them? Aye, it might be. Or it might not, if the participants dinna understand what they've been set to doing. Dicky twitches. Well, I'll get right onto it. Anything else? Dicky shakes his head. Next agenda item. There has been little progress overnight. The promised lead on Mikey Blair's wild ride came forward voluntarily, but turns out to be a rent boy who knows nothing about anything. They're still looking for Vivian Crawler's embalming expert, but much digging reveals that she has something of a reputation on the local fetish scene. Half an hour in the right pubs, and you could probably have figured that much out for yourself. So it is that you and Kamal, who you pick up in the ICIU annex where he's talking to Moxie about something fitting in too well by half, you think, end up visiting Appleton Tower. It's not quite that fast, of course. You are still somewhat freaked by yesterday's late-night developments. Dorothy being an emotional wreck in need of support is unexpected. And the rest is just plain disturbing. So you're not paying 100% attention to the job, which is why Kamal brings you up short as you're scurrying in circles trying to do three things at once.
What exactly are we being sent to do?
He demands. You stop dead, caught in the act of rifling through Speedy's in-tray to see what Moxie left unfinished at shift change. That's a good question. You pull up the stack of notes Dicky passed you and sign Kamal onto it. Let me finish here, then we can go grab a coffee and read this stuff. And so you go find the nearest Costas in a wee shop unit on Rayburn Place and get your heads into the backgrounder that turns out to be a committee report from Carl in Dresden, Andrea in New York, Felix in Bishkek, and a bunch of other ICIU cops around the world. You read fast. This is amazing. While you were off shift, the intelligence team working behind the scenes on Babylon have been busy. It looks like they chased the repaired vacuum cleaner, and then some. For a miracle, they've been sharing their research with their overseas counterparts, and they've been pooling results. All the parts come from cheap generic design storefronts.
Who set them up?
Asks Kamal. Good question. The storefronts all take PayPal, and investigation traces them to a variety of servers in the Far East, most of which, upon further examination, where possible, turn out to be part of one of three botnets. People are dying in domestic accidents, you tell him, still skimming ahead through the notes. A vacuum cleaner shorts its battery out into a bath, or a non-standard cartridge in a spa machine contains contaminated fluid, or a sunbed safety interlock is disabled. In each case, the machine has been repaired in the past year. Whoever carried out the repair saved money by using an OEM part template bought over the net and printed on the local machine. The part is physically a correct fit, but compromised. The vacuum's hose contains an electrical connection and links to the power supply, the sunbed latch. Kamal shakes his head.
Very strange.
It's completely crazy, isn't it? You skim another summary. I don't see how it's possible. We're up to 14 murders now. Then they'd need a lot of different sabotaged appliances, at least 14, probably more. Kamal nods grimly.
Many more. More than two per target, perhaps more than five. You should search the homes of your local victims, tear everything apart, and see what else comes to light. There may be many more. I think we may be mistaking the elephant's tail for a bell pull.
But who's designing the things?
Ask this academic.
Kamal sounds disturbed. Got any ideas what to ask about? He pulls his specs on and points.
How about task distribution and where the designs come from?
That side of it. I've been looking into this. The Chinese government began prioritizing design 20 years ago in their universities. India, more recently. The recycling initiative. Make do and mend is big this decade. And the internet combined to give them ready access to markets, and the spread of cheap fabbers allows them to export bespoke design patterns. WIPO are trying to do something about the generics, but design and trade secret laws are not universally harmonized. Not like copyright and patent regulations. It's part of what you've been tugging on from the other end, the supply of feedstock to the grey market fabs. You've been looking at demand for counterfeit or contraband goods, and the supply of raw materials and designs feeding them. This is clearly related, but not in a way you can put your finger on just yet. Kamal picks up his coffee cup.
The problem is not to design replacement parts that have lethal flaws. The problem is not even to insert them in the victims' households. True, some will live large, not repair or recycle domestic appliances, but most will be vulnerable somewhere. An exercise machine at their gym, a brake assembly in their car. No, the problem is how to coordinate the operation.
He looks you in the eye.
It is scary, yes.
It's not so much scary as incomprehensible. This murder's MO stands in relation to a normal homicide as a super jumbo to a Cessna. Murder I can get, but why do it this way? It's positively baroque. Who would do such a thing? It's inhuman.
You're absolutely right,
Kamal says, pushing his cup aside.
It is inhuman.
You're not going on that AI trip again, you say wearily. Kamal shakes his head.
Precisely who is sending us to interview this academic?
Tricky. You stop. Boots fingered you to talk to him. Boots, you say. An expert system for matching personnel assignments to tasks. Huh. You finish your coffee. But it's just human resources software.
If we know how it works, it isn't artificial intelligence,
snarks Kamal. He stands up.
Shall we go?
Edinburgh University isn't built around a campus. Its buildings are scattered through the south side of the city centre, sandwiched between the old town and the meadows, rubbing shoulders with charity shops and cheap apartments and fast food joints. Its reputation for academic excellence, combined with geographical dispersion, has stood it in good stead in these harsh times. Unlike many rival institutions, it's still in business, although two-thirds of its students this decade have never set foot in Scotland in their lives. You went to university and did the whole halls of residence, living off student loans thing back in the day. You did your master's in policing, policy and leadership on day release with distance learning. No faculty within a couple of hundred kilometres offered it as a part-time residential. And you got a taste of the chill wind that was even then beginning to blow through the halls of academia. A wind that since then risen to a howling tornado, blowing shards of razor-sharp glass, stripping staff and student bodies to the bone as the whole structure of higher education changes. And you're paying for that sheepskin to this day. Was it worth it? Who knows? One thing's for sure, university isn't what it used to be. Some things remain, the old buildings, for example. Appleton Tower is every bit as much a crass, brutalist statement on the edge of the old town as it ever was, if a bit more crumbly about the edges than when it was last refurbished nearly 20 years ago. It's a listed building, the concrete bones of a different era, tempered in the white heat of Wilsonian techno-optimism and remodelled in the late teens. But there's no desk-bound receptionist waiting to greet you behind the grime-streaked glass lobby doors that once handled a stream of students, nor will the door open when you push it. Perplexed, you pull up a voice call. Hello, is that Dr. MacDonald? I'm Inspector Kavanagh. We have an appointment. I'm downstairs right now. How do I... Okay, thanks. Bye. You hang up and glance at Kamal, who's looking around with wrinkled brow, as if he's just smelled something bad. Dr. MacDonald will come down and let us in, you tell him. There's an access control system. Now you know to look for it. The discreet box by the door tells you all you need to know. Receptionists are too expensive for universities in these straitened times. In fact, it's not just the Appleton Tower lobby that's showing signs of wear and tear. Half the buildings on Bristow Square are closed or boarded, one or two blinking lease available flags in your specs. For a couple of decades, tuition fees rose faster than inflation until the inevitable happened and the bubble burst. The collapse catalyzed by the first of the top-tier universities rolling out their distance learning products in the middle of a recession sent the higher education industry into a tailspin. EdUni has always been one of the top double handful and is still viable. But times are harsh, and full-time undergraduate students are an endangered species. You're beginning to get impatient by the time you spot a sign of life through the window. At first, you think it's a homeless vagrant who's managed to sneak inside, but as he approaches the front door with a determined shuffle, you realize that he's looking for you. He's bald on top, with a round head, stubby nose, and tiny, angry-ish eyes. With his tattered denim overalls and grubby coat, he looks like a member of the chorus from Deliverance, the musical. You wonder, is there some mistake? Despite a nagging sense that you've seen him somewhere before. Then he opens the door and speaks with an ultra-posh Morningside accent. Inspector Kavanagh, I'm Dr. MacDonald. You'll be following me, please. You wave Kamal inside hastily. Certainly. Do you know why we're here? MacDonald sniffs, then gestures towards a darkened tunnel between lift doors. I'm sure you'll tell me in your own good time, he says unctuously. We can talk in my office. The lift is battered and has clearly seen better days. It squeaks between floors, bumping and jolting to a stop on the 9th. We don't use the bottom two floors at present, MacDonald tells you, punching buttons on an access control keypad. This way. Here, at least, there's fresh paint on the walls, and the thin carpet isn't worn through. And there is a receptionist at a desk in an open area of corridor, her head bent over a pad. Fading printouts pinned to corkboards on the wall, and the gawky-looking student staring blankly at them tell you that you are, in fact, stuck in a time warp from the noughties, or maybe on the set of a documentary video about the rise and fall of higher education. MacDonald pushes open a beige door and ushers you into a cramped office. There's a huge, old-fashioned-looking monitor on his desk and a glass-fronted bookcase holding a small, dog-eared collection of journals and books. Judging from the dust and the yellowing corners, they haven't been read in a while. Trophy copies of his papers, you assume. He flops down into a cheap swivel chair and gestures at the two fabric-padded bucket seats in front of his desk. Make yourselves at home. I'm sorry I can't offer you any hospitality. Our coffee machine's broken again, and the corporate hospitality budget is somewhat lacking this decade. Thanks, you manage. The sense of déjà vu resolves itself. You have seen him before, in a pub somewhere in town. Brain cells grind into action, and you recite a memorized script. We're here to gather information which may be of use to us in an ongoing investigation into a crime. I'm required to tell you that you're not under suspicion of any criminal wrongdoing. We're here to consult you as an expert witness. But we have to record this interview for use in our ongoing investigation, and if you incriminate yourself, the resulting transcript may be used in evidence. You tap the right arm of your specs, then clear your throat. Are you all right with that? Any questions? I shall remember not to confess to any murders I didn't commit. MacDonald seems to find your caution inappropriately amusing. You're about to repeat and rephrase when he adds, I understand you're in need of domain-specific knowledge. He leans forward, smirk vanishing. Why me? Your name came out of the hat. You decide to press on. Probably he got the message. In any case, having an inappropriate sense of humour isn't an arrestable offence. We're investigating a crime involving some rather strange coincidences that appear to involve some kind of social network. The half-smile vanishes from Dr. MacDonald's face instantly. You're a permanent lecturer in informatics with a research interest in automated social engineering and something called Athena? Our colleagues recommended you on the basis of a review of the available literature on morality prosthetics and network agents. Kamal, sitting beside you with crossed arms, nods very seriously. MacDonald looks nonplussed. Really? Coincidences? He pauses. Coincidences? A social network? Can you tell me what kinds of coincidences we're talking about here?
Fatal ones, says Kamal.
Damn! MacDonald's expression is frozen. You spare Kamal a warning glance, then say, We're here for a backgrounder, nothing more, to see if your research area can give us any insights into what's going on. I'm afraid I've got to admit that I'm not up on your field. Tell me, Professor, what is automated social engineering? You sit back, mimic his posture, and smile at him. It's all basic body language bullshit, but if it puts him more at ease... Yes. MacDonald visibly relaxes. How much do you know about choice architecture? He's got you. You glance sidelong at Kamal, who shrugs minutely. Not a lot. The phrase rings a very vague bell, but no more than that. Suppose you tell me. If only my students were so honest. Let's review some basic concepts. In a nutshell, when you or I are confronted with some choice, say, whether to buy a season bus pass or to pay daily, we make our decision about what to do by using a frame, a bunch of anecdotes and experiences that help us evaluate the choice. You can control how people make their choices, even to the point of making them choose differently, if you can modify the frame. There's a whole body of research on this field in cognitive psychology. Anyway, choice architecture is the science of designing situations to nudge people towards a desired preference. You might want to do this because you're marketing products to the public, or for public policy purposes. There's a whole political discourse around this area called libertarian paternalism.
how to steer people towards choosing to do the right thing of their own free will. Now it clicks where you've heard this stuff before. There was a fad for it about 10 years ago, trials on reducing binge drinking by giving pubgoers incentives to switch off the hard stuff after a couple of pints, free soft drinks and so on, which failed to accomplish anything much because the real problem drinkers weren't in the pubs in the first place, much less drinking to socialise. But the Pimms-quaffing policy wonks didn't get that. You nod, suppressing disappointment. Is that all? But MacDonald reads your gesture as a cue to continue in lecture mode. It's another approach to social engineering. Take policing, for example. He nods at you. There's the law, which we're all expected to be cognizant of and to obey. And there's the big stick to convince us that it's a lot cheaper to play along than to go against it. Yourselves. And the courts and prison and probation services and all the rest of the panoply of justice. However, it should be obvious that the existence of law enforcement doesn't prevent crime. In fact, no offence to your good selves, it can't. For starters, in modern societies, the law is incredibly complex. There are at least 8,000 offences on the books in England, and about the same in this country. Enough that you people have to use decision support software to figure out what to charge people with. And perhaps an order of magnitude more regulations for which violations can be prosecuted. Ignorance may not be a defence in law, but it's a fact on the ground. To make matters worse, while some offences are strict liability, possession of child porn or firearms being an absolute offence, regardless of context, others hinge on the state of mind of the accused. Is it murder or manslaughter? Well, it depends on whether you meant to kill the victim, doesn't it? He pauses. Are you following this? Just a sec. You flick your fingers at the virtual controls, roll your specs back in time a minute to follow MacDonald, who is on a professorial roll. Yes, I'm logging you loud and clear. If you'll pardon me for asking, though, I asked about automated social engineering, not for a lecture on the impossibility of policing. Perhaps you let a little too much irritation into your voice as he shuffles defensively. I was getting there. There's a lot of background. MacDonald shakes his head. I'm not having a go at you, honestly. I'm just trying to explain the background to our research group's activity. Kamal leans forward.
In your own time, Doctor.
He doesn't look at you, doesn't make eye contact, but he's clearly decided to nominate you for the bad cop role, which is irritating, because you'd pegged him for that niche. All right. Well, moving swiftly sideways into cognitive neuroscience. In the past 20 years, we've made huge strides using imaging tools, direct brain interfaces, and software simulations. We've pretty much disproved the existence of free will, at least as philosophers thought they understood it. A lot of our decision-making mechanics are subconscious. We only become aware of our choices once we've begun to act on them.
and a whole lot of other things that were once thought to correlate with free will turn out also to be mechanical. If we use transcranial magnetic stimulation to disrupt the right temporoparietal junction, we can suppress subjects' ability to make moral judgments. We can induce mystical religious experiences. We can suppress voluntary movements, and the patients will report that they didn't move because they didn't want to move. The TMPJ finding is deeply significant in the philosophy of law, by the way. It strongly supports the theory that we are not actually free moral agents who make decisions, such as whether or not to break the law, of our own free will. In a nutshell, then, what I'm getting at is that the project of law, ever since the Code of Hammurabi, the entire idea that we can maintain social order by obtaining voluntary adherence to a code of permissible behavior under threat of retribution, is fundamentally misguided. His eyes are alight. You can see him in the Cartesian lecture theatre of your mind, pacing door to door as he addresses his audience. If people don't have free will or criminal intent in any meaningful sense, then how can they be held responsible for their actions? And if the requirements of managing a complex society mean the number of laws have exploded until nobody can keep track of them without an expert system, how can people be expected to comply with them? Which is where we come to the Athena Research Group. Actually, it's a joint European initiative funded by the European Research Council, currently piloting studies in social network augmented choice architecture for prosthetic morality enforcement. You look at Kamal silently. Kamal looks at you, and for a split second you can read his mind. Kamal is thinking exactly the same thought as you, or any other cop in your situation, which is this. What drug is he on? Would you run that by me again? You ask. Certainly. He nods. Prosthetic morality enforcement. The idea is that, by analogy, if a part of your body is deficient or missing, you can use a prosthetic limb or artificial organ. Well, our ability to make moral judgments is hardwired, but it's been so far outrun by the demands of complex civilization that it can't keep up. For example, have you ever wondered why discussions in chat rooms or instant messaging turn nasty so easily, or wander off topic? It's because the behavioural cues we use to trigger socially acceptable responses aren't there in a non-face-to-face environment. If you can't see the other primate, your ethical reasoning is impaired, because you can't build a complete mental image of them, a cognitive frame. It's why identity theft and online fraud are such a problem. There's no inhibition against robbery if the victim is faceless. So, we need some kind of prosthetic framework to restore our ability to interact with people on the net as if they're human beings we're dealing with in person. And that's what Athena is about. Society has become so complicated that people can't reliably make moral choices. But Athena will nudge them into doing the right thing anyway. His eyes glitter maliciously in their saggy pouches. If it works properly, you'll be needing a new job by and by.
Anwar. Getting answers. Sleep comes hard, and after tossing and turning uneasily in the cold, wide bed, Bibi's still away. You rise early and head for the office. You're running on autopilot, going through the motions in yesterday's soiled clothes, because your mind is elsewhere, scampering and spinning the spiked hamster wheel of your fears. Tariq is dead. That hurts, even before the stabbing fear that you might be responsible. Answers. There must be an answer somewhere. Kicked the bucket. The dead-eyed man and the not beer bubbling away in the attic and the too-good-to-be-true job and Adam's sly suggestion that you've been trolled and suggestion for cashing in on it. You want answers. Because if Adam's right and the independent republic of Issyk-Kulistan isn't just a sock puppet but a flat-out fiction, a Potemkin republic set up to snare the Siloviki, you're in violation of the terms of the license they made you sign when they released you. And that's you back inside that cell in Sochten for another 6 months. At least, if they don't find something new to charge you with. And your hamster mind is skittering ahead in blind panic, trying to figure out ways around the onrushing wall of steel spikes. Maybe if you can prove you've been acting in good faith, or perhaps if it is a fake, you can resign and dob them into Mr. Weber or Inspector Butthurt, demonstrate you're a good and responsible citizen, assuming the madman with the suitcase doesn't come after you. The office is as you left it when you received Bibi's panicky call yesterday afternoon. It feels like an infinity ago. You sit down, open up your laptop and check for email. Nothing from head office, just a handful of spam. Actually, there hasn't been anything from head office, the foreign ministry, this week. No updates, no memos, no bulletins and reminders about policy on export licenses, charges for visas, cancelled passports, office supplies. You frown and check your settings. They look all right, but how can you be sure? Maybe the ministry's mail server is sulking. Or perhaps there's a public holiday that lasts all week and nobody thought to tell you. Or a general strike, or a meteor strike. Whatever the cause, it's disturbing. So you turn to your handy quick reference guide to running a consular mission and bounce around the hyperlinks until you come to a list of voice contacts. Ah, technical support. Issyk-Kulistan is 4 hours ahead of Edinburgh. You paste the contact into your phone app and wait patiently as it tries to connect. And tries to connect. And clicks over to dump you in voicemail hell. An interminable announcement in the sonorous Turkic dialect rolls over you before switching to English and informing you that you have reached the mailbox of Senior Consular Support Engineer Kennebek Bakiyev. Direct customer support is available on Mondays and Wednesdays between the hours of 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. For outside hours support, please leave a message after the tone. Beep! I'm sorry, this mailbox is now full. You stare at the screen. What the fuck? What the fucking fuck? The calendar on your desktop is telling you that today is Wednesday and the time is 9:10 local time, 1:10 in Bishkek. You're not an idiot. You weren't born yesterday. You know exactly what's going on here. You're supposed to buy the story and sit tight until next Monday, aren't you? It's a delaying tactic. What kind of technical support line is available for 10 hours a week, carefully timed for when most of its customers are still asleep in their beds? They're gaslighting you, or maybe not. A sudden moment of doubt. Is it Kulistan is very poor? What if they can't afford to run a proper support desk or helpline? If this is the best they can do, how secure is your pay? You check the phone wiki again and again, digging deeper, looking for clues. Then a thought strikes you, and 30 seconds later you've got another number. You feed another contact to the phone app, and 10 seconds later a voice answers you in the flattened vowels of London's East End. Hello, you've reached the consulate of the Independent Republic of Issyk Kulistan. How can I help you? I, not we, you notice. Hi, you say. This is Anwar at the Scottish consulate. Listen, can you tell me, have you had any email through from the ministry since Monday afternoon? It takes a minute or two for you to get Mr. Eastender to grudgingly acknowledge your identity, and another minute for him to get the picture. But by the time you put the phone down, you know two new facts. That Eirik have only bothered to establish a one-man consular presence in England, and no, he hasn't heard anything from head office either. Your moustache twitches at the half-imagined odour of dead Ratus Norvegicus, and you turn to your browser. There are news aggregators and search engines and attention proxies, and you are a master of the web, a veritable expert. Even though you're having to pipe everything through a mess of translation agents, it's but the work of half an hour for you to churn through 100 searches, refining and reducing and recycling your terms until you've got a pretty good idea of what's not going on. There's no public holiday today. There are no football matches, riots, or debates going on in the Chamber of Deputies. More significantly, a bit more digging reveals that there are no bandits, bank robberies, or bombings. In fact, Issyk Kulistan is a bit of a news black hole. It's as if a cone of internet silence has descended across the entire country, and nobody outside has noticed. Your skin crawls. You're running low on excuses. If Adam's right, then the sock puppet nation is about to be wadded up and thrown away. And you know too damned much. You know about empty-eyed men with suitcases they want you to look after, and trade delegations with bags of not bread mix. You don't have to be Inspector Rebus to know what happens to bagmen who aren't sitting tight when the music stops. You try a different strategy and waste a few minutes hunting for notifications of service outages afflicting the major trunks in and out of the country. Then you have a moment of blinding realization. Voicemail! You flip through the ministry's online directory until you come to a different section. With a shaky finger, you drag the address card into your phone and prod the connect button, already rehearsing your abject apologies. It rings twice, then a man answers it, speaking an unfamiliar language. There's music in the background, tinny voices singing. Hello, you say tentatively. Is Colonel Datka there? One moment. The speaker's English is very good, almost unaccented. There's a scraping sound as of a hand covering a mobile phone, some muffled conversation. Felix is tied up right now, but he'll be along in a minute. Who should I say is calling? Your tongue swells abruptly and you cough. To whom am I speaking? This is Bhaskar. Whoever Bhaskar is, he sounds amused. And you are? This is the Scottish consulate. You see, your voice barely above a dry-mouthed whisper. I need to talk to the colonel.
You see, the Scottish consulate.
Yes. You swallow, hoping the phone app they gave you is adequately encrypted. There's a problem.
A problem? And for this problem, you need to talk to Felix Dadka.
His tone sharpens. Yes. You realize you're clutching the edge of your desk as if it's a life belt. I know what you're doing, what you're using me for, and I can't.
Wait, please. Ah, Felix, you had better explain this to the Colonel himself. He'll speak to you now.
There's a muffled noise, as of a phone being passed between hands, and then a new speaker.
This is Felix Dadka. Identify yourself.
The background music has stopped. It's Anwar Hussein from Edinburgh, your honorary consul. The colonel snorts superciliously.
And you are calling because...
All your indignation comes boiling up at once. My cousin's dead, Colonel. Since your man arrived in my city with his curious demands, surely this is not a coincidence. And it is not bad enough being held up to ridicule by the other diplomats of this city. Oh, no! Everybody knows that Issyk Kulistan is a front for some strange diplomatic game. And the trade delegations were the bread mix that is a culture medium for illegal nanosystems. You have me handing this stuff out openly as if on the street corner, where the police can find me red-handed. And this week even the news stops. There is no news, as if you cannot even be bothered to maintain the pretense. Have you no decency, sir? There's no sound from the other end of the phone, but a glance at the screen tells you the connection is still there. Sir? There's a pause. Then Dadka asks, softly, meditatively, terrifyingly,
What do you mean? Bread mix.
Light-headed and nauseous, you collect your possessions and walk out of the consulate. You leave behind the safe and its contents, the travelling trunk with its commercial samples of bread mix, the laptop, the furnishings, the stale posturing and lies. You're going home, home to your family and your future and the things that matter to you. Fuck Adam and his stupid get-rich-quick scheme, scamming scammers. Fuck Colonel Dadka and his secret policeman's eyes. Fuck the Colonel's man, Christie, whoever he is. You don't need any of them. They can't give you back Tariq's annoying jokes, his sly wordplay. They can't give you an extra minute to say goodbye to your cousin. And if they can't do that, how heavily should your children's futures weigh on your shoulders? If it comes to it, you'll turn yourself in to Mr. Webber and shop the lot of them. Go back inside Sochten, if that's what it takes to keep them away from Bibi and the bairns. You're hungry. You forgot to make yourself breakfast this morning. And you're sick at heart as you march determinedly towards the tram stop. You're walking away from a good solid job that was paying you. Well, it wasn't paying you well in purely monetary terms, but it got you respect. And after what you threw in Colonel Dadka's face, or more accurately his ear, you have zero expectation of keeping the job. Bibi will be livid. She'll also be exhausted from sitting up all night with Aunt Samina and Uncle Talib and the kids, and she's probably back at work by now. Yes, you can see all this. Nevertheless. You check your phone for the tram schedule, and it flashes a red warning at you. Delays expected due to an accident on Leith Walk. Get the bus instead. You can see at least one tram with your own eyes, but who knows how the network works? So you stop by the foot of the mound, outside the big art gallery, and poke at the timetable. You've hit the morning lull after rush hour, it seems, when half the buses return to their depots. Irritated, you put your phone away and start walking. It's only a couple of kilometres, and the weather's fine.
You'll even chance a short cut over the mound, normally a steep climb best left to the bus's fuel cell. Halfway up the first flight of worn stone steps, behind the gallery, your phone shivers. You glance at it, startled. It's an invite to join a new startup group on some business network, one of the half-assed byblows of LinkedIn and Facebook that offer virtual corporate hosting to folks too cheap to rent an office. Somehow, it's dodged your spam stack. You're about to flag it when you see the sender's name. John Christie. You mash your thumb on the delete icon with a shudder, like you're crushing a sleepy autumn wasp. A minute later, the phone buzzes again. It's a different invite, this time for some kind of file repository. Same sender. The menacing buzz of the hornet circling your head, looking to sting. He's relying on your natural curiosity to make you break cover, nose inquisitively into his new business scheme. It's a trap, of course. You've had enough. You flip the phone to flight mode and pocket it. It's not like you need a map to find your way home, and when you get there, you'll... What will you do? You're breathing harder as you climb faster, but you know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to take his luggage and dump it out the backyard. You're going to call Inspector Butthurt and cough everything you suspect. The weird coincidences, the job that's too good to be true. Give them the bucket, the bread mix, and Colonel Datka's phone number. Much good may it do them. You're going clean, the cleanest you've been, and end the tears and the in-between. Yes. Get your priorities right. Nassim, Farida, Bibi, your parents, and uncles and aunts and cousins and nephews and nieces and family. There's a buzzing as of an angry swarm of bees from your pocket. Then your phone rings. You pull it out and stare at it. It's in flight mode. How can this be? It's ringing, though. The screen says international call. You answer the phone. Hello? The voice at the other end of the connection is heavily accented, male.
Presidential Palace, it says. Please wait.
You stop and lean on the iron railing near the top of the steps, just below the intersection with Market Street. Turning to face back the way you came, you stare out across the deep gulf of Princes Street Gardens, the classical stone pile of the Royal Scottish Academy, towards the stony frontages of the new town, blocks hacked out of history. There's a light breeze blowing, and high above you it tears cotton wool shards from the passing clouds. There's a sour taste in your mouth. After a moment, you realize it's fear. A new voice, gravelly with a faint American accent.
Good afternoon. Am I speaking to Mr. Anwar Hussein?
You half recognize it, but you can't quite place where you've heard him before. Yes, you say cautiously.
Excellent. Please accept my apologies for intruding on you. I understand, I'm told, you have recently had a death in your family.
Yes. You bite your lower lip, then glance around, just in case somebody's watching you.
I'm very sorry about that.
A momentary pause.
I gather that when you called Felix Datka half an hour ago, we had a slight misunderstanding.
I resigned, you say icily, tightening the shreds of your dignity around you.
Yes, he told me that. Mr. Hussein, Anwar, I want to explain to you, matters are not so simple that you can just resign.
You'd tell him to fuck right off, except he rang through to your phone while it was in flight mode, and that's supposed to be impossible, isn't it? Or isn't there a back door for the emergency services? You vaguely remember hearing something about that, something about external emergency reactivation. I'm quitting, you repeat, less firmly. Who are you, anyway?
I'm Colonel Felix Dabka's boss,
says the man on the phone.
You can call me Baska, or Professor Tanayev. I am, very indirectly, your employer, or ex-employer, if you insist on resigning.
The tram bells far below might as well be fire alarms telling you to get out now. Professor Tanayev, you're the colonel's boss. How exactly does that work? He chuckles.
They can kick me out of the presidential palace, but they can't strip me of tenure.
Silence. You realize you're clutching the phone like it's turned into a gold brick between your fingers. President of Issyk-Kulistan?
No, president of Kyrgyzstan. Issyk-Kulistan is a wholly owned subsidiary operated by a shell company, if you prefer business metaphor. Felix's job is to keep IRIC running for as long as we need it.
Now you cringe and start looking round, but not for snoopers. You're more worried about assassination drones cruising overhead, looking for a lock on your skull. Why are you interested in me?
Because you've been approached by a highly questionable businessman working for a foreign private equity organization. They're not angel investors so much as fallen angels. Please stop looking around like that. You'll only attract unwanted attention. And it is important to us that this businessman should not be frightened away or prematurely introduced to the police. Yes, I said prematurely. Mr. Hussein, are you paying attention? Hello?
There's a stream of traffic flowing along Bank Street, and you'll only get yourself run over if you try and dash across it. The crawling sensation in the small of your back won't go away, but the fire in your lungs is growing, so you stop, bent over, wheezing, so out of shape, Bibi will scold you, and hold the phone to your ear again.
Hello? Hello?
May you come to the attention of important people. Supposedly it's an ancient Chinese curse, but the modern Kyrgyz version has got you bang to rights. I'm here.
Excellent. Listen, Mr. Hussein. Anwar. May I call you Anwar? This is only for the next day or so. You have heard of sting operations? A sting is in progress, and your consular post is part of the bait. We would like you to continue with the job and comply with any of John Christie's requests. If they remain reasonable, of course, while we gather evidence against his associates, for whose arrest there will be a generous reward, incidentally. Colonel Dabka assures me that this fellow is the key to a major international criminal investigation, and he will see to it that Europol treat you as a material witness when...
What about the bread mix? You burst out.
The what?
You have never heard a president sound confused before. Not that you've ever knowingly spoken to a president before. It's not like they're on Facebook, sending friend requests, but it's not what you expect from seeing them on the political blogs. The bread mix, you repeat. Insect-free, fair-trade, organic bread mix, barley rye, produce of People's Number 4 Grain Products Factory of Issyk-Kulistan, that I'm supposed to give samples of to visitors and never put in a bucket and ferment with a special extra ingredient. There's noise on the line as the president speaks away from his headset, his tone rising imperiously.
Felix, what's this I hear about our consulate receiving bread mix?
There's a delay.
Oh, I see. Mr. Hussein, you are not to worry about the bread mix. Apparently the criminals we have been investigating have parasites. They've been using your consulate for drop-shipping contraband, but you shouldn't worry about this. It is minor, and if you play your part, for just a little while longer we will arrest them all, including this Christie person. I will ensure that you are well looked after. You have my word on the matter. If you'll excuse me, I must go now. Just remember, play for time. Goodbye for now.
Your phone goes dead, and you blink at the screen. It is indeed in flight mode. Then you look up. High above the rooftops, 20 or 50 meters up, the grey discus of a surveillance drone ghosts past the elaborate columns and stone railings and domes of the former bank headquarters. Blink, and it's gone. But the sensation that you are being watched remains.